Okay, cool. So Sue asked, let's do this one. Can you all see the question as I'm answering it? Because that's going to make my life a lot easier. Can you see that one? Let's see. Anyone just let me know. Oh, you can see it? Okay. So you see like exactly the text, right? So then I don't have to read them all. This will save my voice. Okay, good. So for virtual coaching practice, if I'm an RN, NP, and now as coach. Okay, so Sue, this is a really good question because oftentimes people think they have to carry insurance for whatever their highest certification, licensure, thing is. But in fact, it's more a question of what kind of work you're doing. So, for example, like, would I have to carry legal malpractice insurance? Because my argument is that I'm not acting as anyone's lawyer. I'm not offering legal services. I'm not practicing law. So, why would I have to carry insurance for that? That's kind of the way that I see it. If though you're still acting as that in some other capacity or privately or on the side or something like that, then yes, you would want that kind of insurance. But if you're really strictly running a coaching practice, and you're not acting as any of those things and you're not properly or you're not improperly like advertising it or, you know, not following any of the scope of practice tips that I give you, it should be fine. I guess the only thing I would cross-reference with a either local to you attorney or like even your state might have a licensure board or somebody you can contact there to ask is if you need it just to maintain your license. Like some attorneys have, or some states have that about attorneys. So that might be something you want to look into. Okay, cool. So hopefully that was helpful, Sue. Let me know. Debbie. Okay, I'm going to get to Debbie's question. The difference I have found between an evergreen webinar and live. Boy. Well, I actually kind of bucked the trend and started with an evergreen webinar when everybody tells you you have to start with live. So just so everyone knows, an evergreen webinar is a webinar that somebody could sign up for anytime. Like they can go on your website, just hit sign up, and like they get an email, they can watch the webinar, and anybody can kind of enter the funnel at any time. Versus live, it's like I say that the webinar is going to be Monday, January 24th at 3 p.m., and that's it, right? So I have found that the Evergreen webinar was a great way to test my webinar. It's what made me know that it was good, that it was, and what I mean by that is that it was converting to sales. And so that then made me comfortable throwing ads behind it. And, you know, really that's what sustains my business week to week. Like we make sales pretty much every day for the Ultimate Bundle. And that's because we have an evergreen webinar that then goes to a funnel and people purchase the bundle. So I like evergreen webinars for the stability and consistency. But I think what a lot of people don't understand is that it's still a lot of work because then your job really becomes being a marketer, which I see that as being my job. So that doesn't really bother me. But like, when you rely heavily on an evergreen webinar, then you have to be out there constantly creating content or focusing a lot of big, you know, evergreen long form pieces of content somewhere else to then drive traffic to the evergreen webinar. So for the first few years that I had it, every single piece of content I created would end with like, and that's why you should sign up for my free legal training, 5 steps to legally protect and grow your online business. And that's how I would just drive traffic to that webinar all the time. Once you start driving traffic that way in an organic way, and you see that the funnel is converting because people are purchasing after watching the webinar and going through your emails, then that's when it's a great time to turn on ads. I think the big benefit though to live is just the like, I don't know, what do you call it, like FOMO or immediacy of it. Like people want to be there because they know you're going to be there. And I don't do, if you've ever watched mine, like I don't do the thing. I don't lie about like when my people watch my evergreen webinar, they know it's recorded. It's, I'm not like trying to pretend like Stacy from Minnesota just said, like I don't do that. So I think it's a big benefit then when you do it live and you can say like, you know, we can interact, we can have people ask questions, I can update in real time when people don't understand something. So that's a big benefit, right? People feel like they get a little bit more of your attention, especially when you can advertise that you'll take questions, like do a question and answer. So our live webinar promos tend to be really, really big. And so you get like a big influx of cash all at once. But then the reason I really love having the evergreen one is because then we are doing like 6 figures of that per month anyway. So it's all like, to me, it's an either or. I would do both. Personally, I started with the evergreen. Yeah. Let me know if that's helpful, Debbie. All right, let's do Mandy's question. Thanks for submitting these questions this way. This is really helpful. Mandy, you can like, so on any page where you have opt-in boxes for your newsletter, you should have a link to your privacy policy, your disclaimer, just like on the page. You don't have to have the actual language in it. And I would say, like, within your newsletter, for all of you, whether you're writing a blog post, a piece of content on social media, or your newsletter, anytime you go to put a disclaimer on something, I always say this to my team too. Like, if you go to put a disclaimer on something, just take a moment to read back what you're writing and make sure it's within your scope of practice, or you're not putting it in a way that's like outside the scope. So you're not giving advice. You're teaching general information, because then it's just simple as saying, like, check with your doctor first, or always speak with your accountant before making big money moves, or whatever. So you can add that information if you really want to there, but it's always a good just like a good checkpoint. It's something I use for myself. So you can use that info there, but I would say just provide links to your disclaimer and your privacy policy on any opt-in page. Tammy, okay. Oh yeah, you can totally use your you can use testimonials from any way that you've worked with people. I think especially when your testimonials are just speaking to like what it's like to work with you, or how good you are, or how much you help them, or whatever. It's okay. Yeah. So yes, that's totally fine. If you haven't yet, you can always use the testimonial release in the bundle, or make sure that the testimonial language is in your one-to-one client contract. But yeah, as long as they've signed that and you've written it, however you've written it, then you can use their words and maybe their photo if they've given you that permission to do whatever you need to do. Something, just a little tip for everybody that I'm seeing work really well for me for the last two sales that I've run in February and the current one, is starting to contextualize testimonials by objection. So what I mean by that is that, like, I used to just like on Instagram stories or wherever else, like we would just pop up a whole lot of testimonials here and there and just be like, look at this nice thing this person said, or look at that nice thing. And then when I started reading the testimonials, I would realize, like, oh, what makes this person's testimonial really helpful? Well, Tammy's testimonial says, like, it was so much easier and faster than I thought. Okay. And like, I love the Ultimate Bundle, and it allowed me to get all my legal documents in place really quickly, right? That's an example. Well, what's the objection that ties back to that testimonial? The objection from people is usually time. There's usually time, money, and then, like, am I the right fit for this thing? So that's a time objection that person, like, clearly had a different, they thought it was going to be different than what it was, right? People, especially with what I do, and I know with what you do as well, like, people have this objection thinking it's going to take a lot of time, it's going to be very difficult, and it's usually not. So now when I share that testimonial, it says, oh, so much easier and faster. I usually put a little bit above it to give context when I share this testimonial to be like, if you're worried that it's going to take you a ton of time to get legal in place, listen to what Tammy had to say, right? So let me know if this is helpful. I'm happy to offer these kinds of like little tips as we go along, but I've just been seeing that that has been really helpful to give a little bit more context. And so I'm doing that with the time thing. I'm doing that with the, like, if you're not sure about this investment, like if you think this is too much, that kind of stuff. Like, it seems like that's helpful to people. Yeah. So think about the objections that you all get most often, you hear from people, and when you're reading your testimonials, think about, like, what objector would this help to overcome, and then tie it back. Give them context. Don't just plop up a bunch of nice words. Yeah. Okay, Kate. Let's see. Yeah. Okay, cool. So, we've talked about this a couple times where, like, terms of use, so the kind of contracts that you include at checkout versus the ones that you have people sign, they are enforceable, right? So they are enforceable. It depends kind of what we're talking about. Like if you're what you brought up here in your question, Kate, about like maybe a cancellation or a chargeback threat, if that ever happens, or like somebody tries to not pay or like cancel their billing, even though they committed, terms of use hold up really well for that kind of stuff. Like we've had like 100% success rate. Lindsay, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure we've never had any issue with enforcing our own terms of use against those kinds of things. I think they're enforceable in general. They are not as enforceable as signed contracts. Sometimes when it comes to the bigger legal issues, like, I don't know, if goodness forbid somebody you were working with died as a result of your work together, like maybe there would be an issue, but it's not the little stuff, the stuff that you're really going to face day to day, it's going to cover those bases. So just make sure you use the terms of use at checkout, that you properly include it, like it says, you know, and something that they have to agree to. And then that after they purchase, you have some sort of automatic email that goes to them with a PDF copy of those terms. That's a great way to cover yourself and make them even more enforceable. Also, anytime you update them, make sure you resend them out to the group and you say, like, these are updated terms that you're subject to for your continued use. Yeah. All right, Tammy. Okay, this is a great question, Tammy. I like this question a lot. What should you focus on as you're launching your course for the first time? I wrote about this in the book a lot because I think what people don't know is that the bulk of your sales are going to come from your email list. It's hard to get people to buy things directly on social media, right? So the bulk of sales are going to come from your email list. Industry average is like 1 to 3%. Like I think 3 is probably pretty high for conversion. So you do the math. If you have 100 people on your email list, it's very few sales, right? So I think often people just don't pay enough attention to the email list and getting that built up, and especially getting the right people on your email list. So what I really encourage people to do is reverse engineer from your course that you're going to sell. So like what kind of freebie would make sense for you to sell for then like those people to purchase your program after they get your freebie, and create that kind of freebie, drive a lot of traffic to that freebie and get people to sign up for it. So that's one thing I wish people would do more. The other thing before launching a course for the first time is making sure that the course is properly designed for what people really want, and that you feel really comfortable talking about the problems that the people are facing, the solutions that you know that they want, and why your program fills the gap. And really, really being introspective about like why, about that those things are really what the other people, the purchasers are concerned about, and not what we're concerned about or think that they should be concerned about. So you asked about what mistakes I made when I first launched the bundle. I mean, when I launched the bundle, I had this idea that I thought it should be separate. Like I thought you guys would get like the legal templates on the one hand and then purchase the trainings on the other. So I beta tested, right? And I thought that was a good idea. I was like, oh, I'm giving people an option. If they don't want it, like, great, right? So I beta sold it and then had interviews with all those people, took like surveys from everyone, like I think maybe 12, 15 people who had purchased it. And everyone resoundingly was like, I wouldn't purchase this without these two things being combined. Like you need to have the ultimate bundle as one, right? And so that's an example of like, I had to put myself aside and what I thought was better. And I was really freaked out that nobody was going to buy it because I thought it was expensive. I felt it was very valuable and like worth it, but also I knew it was a lot of money. I'm not that out of touch. So I was nervous about it, but I was glad that I listened to the people and like adjusted. Yeah, I would say that the other thing, what else did I do in the beginning? I mean, I don't know. I've gotten lucky with the bundle. Like I really, really paid attention to what you all wanted, right? And so because I had already created products that didn't work. So like the bundle was the one that I could kind of correct on, right? But I think it would probably be more helpful for you to know that when I created products in the past that didn't work, they were usually products that I thought were a really good idea, that I didn't do enough research to find out that other people really wanted this. And I didn't lean into my unique differentiators because I was so busy trying to be like everybody else, because I thought, well, if someone else sells this and they're successful, I just have to do it exactly like them in order for me to be successful too. And I didn't spread my own wings and be unique. And so when I created the bundle, nothing like this existed. And that was part of what was unique about it. But I also thought that my approach to the way that I talk about legal, the fact that I don't only talk about legal, I talk about business, was unique. And I had to lean into that. So I was able to correct. Yeah. Let me know if that's helpful or if anybody else has any questions about that stuff. All right, Monica. Yeah. Okay. So Facebook ads, let's talk Facebook ads. When I first started with Facebook ads, I hired the Facebook ads team that I work with right now for their lowest option. I think that they still have, called a strategy party, where they will help you to set up an ad, but then you run and maintain it yourself. And I think it was pretty quick that I was like, I need you guys to run this for me, because it was too much over my head. I know some people do, right? I know, like, this is not over everybody's head. It was just over mine. And I think I was just focused on some bigger like marketing stuff in the business. So it didn't make sense for me to run the ads, but I hired them to do that. And then I hired them to do a full, like, I don't know what you call it, full service, because then they created my creatives. They write the copy. We do like pitches and, you know, a lot of strategy, and then they have an ads manager who's watching it every day. When I started my ad spend, I want to say it was like $2,500 a month. Yeah. So your offers for single sessions now, here's what, do you all want to hear what I would tell you about Facebook ads or about, like, I don't know if this is helpful to anyone. Like, if you want to hear about, like, when should you start or when is it right? Cause like, I just see people make a lot of big mistakes with Facebook ads. Yeah. I think they're changing a lot. I would say that, do you feel like, Monica, that you have your, like, a funnel, even if it's just a marketing funnel, not a sales funnel, but do you feel like you already have that set up? Like, do you have a freebie that people are already opting into? They're going down your emails, and then are they signing up for your single sessions? Like, is that already happening? Cause that's really when you throw ads at things. I think sometimes people, and you might, right? But I just don't know. Yeah. Okay. So people oftentimes will think, like, if you're posting about a freebie or posting about a service and it's not getting traction, sometimes people make the mistake of thinking if you throw ads behind it, then it'll do well. It's actually the exact opposite. Once something is doing really well, you throw ads behind it, and that's when it does like extremely well, right? So I was selling the bundle 10, 20, 30, maybe I was making about $30,000 a month just on the bundle when I decided to put ads behind it. And so that's about 15 bundles a month. And so I was selling that plus my legal templates and plus anything else I was doing. And I was just like, okay, I think I kind of reached the max of what I could do at that time. I had a really small audience. I had a way smaller email list. And so I was like, I want to grow my list. I know that when people watch my webinar, they then buy the ultimate bundle. Like, I know when people get the bundle, they like the bundle. Like, I knew that all that stuff was working. So then throwing ads behind it, once we turned them on, boom, it was like 50,000 a month, 75,000 a month, 100, and just kept going. Right. So that's that. I will also just say that I think ads have changed a lot. For us, at least, they're not as profitable as they used to be. I think on average, they're still profitable. I know they're still profitable, but they're just not as profitable as it used to be. I would say it's just gotten a little trickier, but that's just like online business life. Like, things change, things shift, people use different platforms, they engage with the platform in a different way. So I would encourage you to make sure that whatever you're putting out there is already doing well, and then be like, okay, now I'm going to throw all this stuff at it, right? So I want everyone to see it as a fuel to the fire, but not starting a fire. It's not a fire starter, right? What's that called? Tinder? I don't know what it's called. Not the app, like the actual Tinder. That's what I mean. Okay. I hope that was helpful. All right. So yeah, it's true. That is the analogy. I I don't know what Rupa is, if anyone, if you want to tell me, Sue, but I don't know if it matters, but I just don't know. Let me see. Yeah, I personally feel very uncomfortable with this. Like I don't, from what I know, sorry, a fire alarm's going off. From what I know, this would not be legal, right? For health coaches to be interpreting lab results, even if they were ordered by a doctor. And oftentimes when I've heard about these setups, it's just kind of what do I want to call it? Like a shell, like a shell corporation, or like a sham, a little bit of a sham, in the sense that doctors aren't really involved. They're not, like, they don't know what's going on. They're just ordering it. And it's just like passing through someone. From what I understand from most states' healthcare laws, that would not be legal. Coaches can't interpret or order health or labs, regardless of like, if a doctor orders it for them, they still can't interpret them, if that makes sense. So that's my take on it. Let me know if that's helpful. Okay. Bailey, no, you don't need a business insurance agent. You can buy it directly yourself. The only reason I ever recommend going to an agent is because they'll shop around for you and maybe offer some different policies from different companies, but there's no like legal requirement that you go through an agent. Yeah. Okay, let's see. Susan, I'll answer yours. Yeah, Susan, I mean, typically speaking, services are not taxed in that way. That's not like a hard and fast rule, but it's very unusual. It's weird that your accountant doesn't know. I wonder, have you tried contacting, I don't know what the DRS is, but if you have you tried, maybe it's the Department of Revenue Services or something like that. But have you tried contacting like the tax department for the state of Connecticut, or finance? Like, it depends what it's called there. I'm not sure. But if you've tried, if you could try contacting them. You could also try contacting like a small business association in Connecticut that might have some answers dealing with this. There's also Leanne or Lindsay. Do you remember tip jar, tax jar? What the heck is it called? I remember we have a link to this in the bundle about how you can find out if you need to pay taxes on these kinds of things. Trying to remember. I'm sure Leanne knows, but there is a link in the bundle that goes to this. And Leticia, just make sure you go and post that question into the Q&A box instead. Yeah, tax jar. I thought that was tax jar, tip jar, it's all the same thing. You can check there as a resource. I'm not sure if that will help answer your question, Susan, but I hope so. Yeah. Yeah, Department of Revenue Services. All right, that was a good guess. Is that what I said? I think so. Yeah, I would check that website that we just linked to in the chat. That's what we linked to in the bundle. And then also check out some of those resources. All right, Raj. Raj, do you have a website? If so, then your disclaimer can become its own page on your website. I guess if you don't have a website, well, then I don't know where you'd be posting it, but I guess you could create a Google Doc and then turn it into a PDF and then link to it. I would just never link to like a editable document. That's all. Yeah. Let me know if that's helpful. Okay, TJ, chatter online about legality of testimonials. Using scare tactics. I wonder, TJ, you'd have to tell me in the chat, but are they talking about not so much testimonials as much as like reviews, or I mean, I guess it's a testimonial where you're promised something in exchange for giving the testimonial or review. Like if I say fill out this Google form, and I'll give you a $20 gift card or something like that, or you get a $50 coupon to my template shop. If that's what they're talking about and that stuff is not disclosed, then that is technically against the FTC's regulations. So that might be what they're talking about. But in general, like there's nothing illegal about sharing testimonials. As long as that they're true, like people actually wrote these to you. And then I just always say best practice is to make sure you have the consent. So I would just recommend using, our contracts and using the testimonial release and all that kind of stuff. But otherwise, there's nothing like inherently wrong with testimonials. Let me know if that was helpful. No, could put, yeah, no, I mean, sharing testimonials in general, I can't imagine what would be. I mean, maybe the thing that I've seen in online businesses that people use like inaccurate ones. I mean, that's a problem, obviously, because that could be misleading. But yeah, I think as long as you're sharing genuine testimonials from people that you've gotten the proper release from, even the release is like an extra step, but that's like it's just smart. And so there would be no problem with that I can think of. All right. Esther said, I have a very new business. If you haven't made any money, are you still expected to pay quarterly taxes? So obviously you'd want to check with your CPA on this, Esther, because it's not just as simple as me telling you yes or no, because if you have other income, if you have a spouse or a partner and they have income, and like there's just all these complicated things, it kind of depends. It also depends if like you don't make money this quarter, but then for the second half of the year you do. But in general, no, I mean you pay taxes on what you earn and you pay taxes on the profit of what you earn, but it just kind of depends because of your financial situation and being so specific to you. So that's something I would ask your CPA for sure. And they might just estimate what kind of quarterly taxes. Yeah, it's Susan said it's some states you have to enter a $0 return. The problem is that a lot of people's financial situation is not just usually a business that makes $0. It's like they have income from elsewhere, they have a partner or a spouse, they file jointly, they have child support, they have spousal support. Like people's financial situations are complicated and very unique. And so we never know where the actual income is coming from. And because you have your own business, you're going to be filing on your personal income tax return. So it's all going to be squashed with all the money you're making anywhere else. So yeah, you just want to make sure. Also, if you have a negative, if you have a loss, if you've actually spent more money than you've earned, you still file because you want to carry over that loss. So that's why it's important to talk to a CPA. All right. Sarah, I'm going to answer your NDA agreement. Okay, so if you're working with a consulting group and you know that it's made up of those three and you're meeting with those three, then I just have all three of them sign. I mean, you just never know. Like, you don't know the legal structure of the company and like who's what. I guess, technically speaking, if you just want to be able to have a claim against the company, then you just need to have whoever's authorized on behalf of the company to sign NDAs, like who's responsible, who's the CEO, who's the owner. That person could technically sign, but I don't really see any downside to having all of them sign. If they will. Yeah. And they can sign their names and then put like on behalf of X. But what if that person leaves? I mean, that's why I think about it too. It's like, what if they leave that company, they go to another company and then they talk about your stuff? That's why I would send it to all of them. Raj asked, what is a unique differentiator? So Raj, I talk about unique differentiators when I'm talking about marketing yourself or your business, your product, right? So I think of what makes you unique from your competition, from anything that's been sold before, the way things are typically done, right? It can be unique in many different ways, how it's offered, how it's packaged, how it's delivered, like all kinds of things. So, personally, I would say that one of my unique differentiators about myself as like a marketer and content creator is not being super fear driven, not being super like rah, rah, rah in your face about legal stuff. I think a little bit more laid back and than maybe some other people, and definitely the people I used to work with. And I just market this all in a different way. I also think it's unique that we talk about business stuff too. And I think I talk about business in a really unique way because I talk about building things for longevity and, focusing more on evergreen content than toilet content and this kind of stuff. So I recommend that you learn what that is about yourself and then about your product, right? Like I said, the Ultimate Bundle was unique because it didn't exist. People had access to templates from other people, but they didn't have trainings. Even when they had access to templates, they didn't have access to how-to video tutorials. So I would then lean into all those things in my marketing of my program, of our business, so that I made us stand out. I mean, there were other people doing this when I started. And so that's what I recommend doing. Yeah. Let me know if that's all helpful. In case anybody's just joining us, hey, and you can add your question to the Q&A box, and I'm just going to go through and answer them. I'm having trouble with my voice these days, so for like the last 7 months. So I'm making the questions go up on the screen so that everybody can read them, and then you can add your questions as we go. Yeah. TJ, I'll take your question. Oh, you're saying that the attorney was reluctant to sign a contract that you sent her? Okay, well, I can't comment directly on this situation in terms of like telling you what to do or navigate it since I'm not your lawyer, but like in general, I will tell everyone in the group that if whether you have a client, a person, a friend, a random person online, if they will not sign a contract, if people put up grief about that, I mean, it's up to you. It's your business. You do whatever you want. You also then have to understand the risk. It's like, you can drive without a seatbelt on, but you understand what happens if you get in an accident, right? So it's like, that's kind of how you have to think of it. But I personally am just an advocate for like, if people, I'm just saying like, let's say you present it to her and then she gives you grief about it. I don't know. If people give you grief about signing a contract, then I probably would not work with that person. I definitely would not work with that person. But like I said, it's always your choice. But that's just my take on it because your contracts don't say anything. These contracts, especially, do not say anything scary. Contracts are just a meeting of the mind. They are a memorialization of the things that you guys have agreed to, the terms you've come to reach. And that's it. So like, there really shouldn't be any fuss about it. But, I think that, you know, you asked about how do you balance protection and trust? I just would shift the mindset that sending somebody a contract or sometimes people even have this come up for them when we talk about like getting paid, but like sending contracts, asking for what you need, setting your boundaries, that is not trusting someone. That is not showing them distrust. You are allowed to ask for what you need. You're allowed to be protected. You have a business. So let's like even zoom out one step further. Let's all remember that whatever you're, when you send a contract, when you're asking for payment, when you're doing this or that, you are not doing this. You are a vehicle for your business. So you are just doing what businesses do, right? So when you go to Target, I always use Target as my poor example, but when you go to Target and there are terms on your receipt and stuff, they're not like, oh, I'm sorry. Like we really trust you, but we got to tell you what our return policy is. It's like, it's just business. It is what it is. Right. And it's just part of shopping here. It's part of working with you. And so I think it's not that it's distrustful. I think part of it is that we all have to own that and not treat it. Like I hate when people say, like people do this to me all the time, especially because they know I'm a lawyer, but like people will be like, oh, it's not that I don't trust you, but you know, could you just sign this or whatever? And I'm like, don't apologize for it. You're a business. You're allowed to do this. And there's nothing offensive about it. So part of it's us just owning it, shifting a little bit of our own mindset, not apologizing for running our own businesses. And you're just doing things the right way, right? You're doing that for insurance purposes. You're doing it because something could always happen through a third party thing and you need record. You could be doing it for your taxes. Like there are lots of different, even just business reasons why we do this stuff. So that's just my take on it. Like I think, you know, you don't get crazy with it. Sometimes people ask me questions, legal questions that I think are a little too much. Like it's a little too, like if the paranoia is really coming out, like I think we got to handle that within ourselves and not put it into our customers. And so that's to me where I see the balance of protection and trust is like, we can't do overkill, but just doing the basics of what I've taught you of like send a contract, have business insurance, like have these policies on your site. I don't really think that that's too much to ask. Yeah, but again, TJ is like she's going to Target every week and buying stuff and entering into a contract. You know, she's buying a house, she's signing a contract, she's purchasing a car, she's signing a lease agreement. It's like contracts are a way of life. It's just that's that. We have to also make sure we're not taking on other people's stuff. Like it's just business. It's like this is what we do. I'm sure someone's purchased the Ultimate Bundle who's been like freaked out by looking at the terms of use. And it's like, I know that they're not scary. It's not my intention to scare people or to threaten them or do anything like that. If that is how someone feels, it's kind of on them and they can always talk to me about it. I don't know. That's just my take. This is just my opinion. You can take it or leave it. That's for sure. All right. Oh, thanks, Bailey. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being here. Okay, Karen. So with quarterly taxes, I mean, my preference for you is that you work with a CPA so that you know exactly what you should be paying. You know, you get the stubs if you need them, or you learn how to do it online, or they help you get those set up. But it's kind of hard to figure out what your like anticipated payment should be, especially in the beginning. So that's my tip. And just know that you have to do it on the state level and then the federal level with the IRS. So really my tip is to work with the CPA. It's just so highly individual, like I was saying earlier, like if you have other income and all of that. Yeah. Okay, Leticia. If you all have any more questions, just make sure you pop them in the Q&A because I got two more left, and then I'm gonna take the questions that were submitted ahead of time. And then actually, Leanne, if you really want to, or if you're even able, you could post them in here so that everyone could see them if you want. It's up to you. But I'll answer Leticia's in the meantime. No, I would keep them separate. I would have them sign an engagement letter. Lawyers do that too. I would have it just be an engagement letter and then sign a contract. Just make sure that the like terms are consistent in the engagement, like scope of services is consistent, the price, the hourly, like that kind of stuff. Just make sure it's consistent. That's all. Okay. Yeah, I would recommend using a CPA. I have found this really helpful as my business, you know, grew and evolved over the years. Like when to be able to have somebody on tap to know, like not only to change my quarterlies, to know what to expect. For the first couple of years, I owed a ton of taxes at the end of every year because the business was growing so much faster than what I thought it would, and so we were like behind. So it was just helpful to have that, and because then I would be like, okay, for next year, how do we avoid having a $100,000 tax payment at the end of the year? So, you know, that's those having some kind of open relationship with your CPA should, you know, avoid those conversations and avoid surprises. I think that's like the best thing is like a lot of planning. You know what's coming. Also to be able to have that conversation of like, when is it time for you to become an S Corp, you know, all that kind of stuff. That is really helpful. So I personally really like it. I'm also a big fan of you offloading any services in your business that you really don't need to do that are time consuming, that stress you out. Like the money stuff stressed me out. I was like, I don't want to do bookkeeping. I don't want to do CPA stuff. Let's just get rid of it and I can move on. So that's my little spiel. I think so. All right. I've answered all the questions in the Q&A. If you have a question that you want me to A, you can put it here. Okay, Sarah did. And then I'll answer these and then I'll hop into all the ones. We got a ton from beforehand. Okay. Sarah said, can you share behind the scenes of how you organize your work days or projects? Do you block time or theme days to pre-plan working on the book bundle or podcast? Yeah. I'll like kind of skip back in the business a little bit because right now it's very different having so many people working here that are working really hard behind the scenes doing all kinds of different things. And like Lindsay, who was just here as my director of operations, is like has all the projects and the plans, and like she's just the absolute best. And Leanne is taking care of all of you so well every day. And so it's like there's a lot going on behind the scenes, but I think it's probably more helpful for me to tell you what I did before, especially with the book. I think that the most helpful thing that I did when I was working by myself was start to theme my days. So having like, you know, it depends how your business is kind of built. And if you want to give me more info, you always can. But, you know, I would have days like where I had a lot of outward facing meetings, for example, and I would kind of stack those, like, you know, let's say you make Monday, like your meetings days, all that. If you have client work, like maybe Tuesdays and Thursdays are always your client sessions. And then I would always have a dedicated day for content, usually another half day of creating content, and then like a half day of admin. So there was usually some kind of split like that. That I'm a big fan of that. And I'm a big fan of starting to set boundaries for yourself of being like, I only have, you know, meetings on Mondays, or I only do this on that day. Or if you have a podcast or something like this, you can be like, I only record on Fridays. Like that could be your podcast recording day in batch. Right. So I'm a big fan of doing that and setting boundaries for yourself. I also saw the benefit as time went on to having a little bit of white space as a CEO, that you can kind of let yourself dream a little bit more and think about things, dream up a new project, just kind of sketch some stuff out, like come up with ideas. So that's really important too, if you can let yourself do that. And then I would just say for like you were asking, how do I work on like the book, the bundle, the podcast? I've learned also the art of like never doing something just once. So like if I'm going to do the podcast, for example, I'm not sitting down to do one episode because it's way too much work to like, you know, plan and outline them and then record them and upload all the video and the audio. And, you know, I do research on all the titles. I title them myself. You know, I'm doing all these things, getting resources and then giving everything to the team to kind of run from there. But if I'm doing all of that work, I'm not just recording one podcast episode. So I made a deal with myself before I had Sjogren's syndrome or before I knew I had it. I used to do 2, 3, maybe 4. Like if I split it in a day, I would do like 4 podcast episodes. I'm having difficulty getting through one now, even when they're short, like 15, 20 minutes, I'm having difficulty. Like this is actually a big struggle for me now. So you have to also adjust for like what works for you. Maybe you have children or you have another job, like people have stuff. So you got to adjust, you know, but that would be a big tip I'd have is like, if you're going to sit down and write content or write some emails or some blog posts, like just don't ever do anything once. Cause it's, I think the batching and planning is really helpful. The other thing that Lindsay had me doing when she first came on that was really helpful was that we would theme our weeks in the month. So we would have like week one would be like research week. So I'd be like researching what I'm going to be like what topics and like kind of doing the outlines for them. Week two would be of the month would be like recording week. Week three would be like editing that stuff. Week four would be writing the content that goes along with it, like that kind of stuff. So you can also do it like that. But I'll be honest, like right now, writing a book, in case anybody doesn't know, I just wrote my first book. I just handed in my first full manuscript, almost 90,000 words. Right now I'm editing it. I thought about showing it to you guys, but I'm editing it right now and doing that and running a business. And then like the amount of content that I put out, which is not normal, like it's not a normal human level of content. It's hard. It's very hard to like balance all of this right now. And so I have days like 2 days ago, I think I maybe edited the book for like 5, 6 hours. And then, then I haven't touched it since because it's been like so much heavy business stuff because I'm in the middle of a sale. So I'm like doing all the sales stuff and then like taking care of other things for the business and then getting all the marketing stuff set up for the book. So it's a lot. It's a lot. But yeah, when you go into a project, like whatever you're going to work on, whether it's your YouTube channel or your podcast or your writing or whatever, just try to like put your head down, focus on that thing, get as much done of that and batch it as much as possible. I don't think people realize how much energy and time is lost, like switching between all those things all the time. And if you're really short on time, I would just really consider how much time are you spending on social. I'm like, I write about this in the book, but I always say that like, to me, social media is the like, remember how after school you went to go out and play, but like my parents didn't do this, but normal parents would have told you like, you have to get your homework done before you can go out to play. I want you to think of social media like you're going out to play. And if you have not gotten your homework done, which is building an email list, writing consistently, I hope weekly, to your email list, focusing on building out some other long form platform outside of social media, then you have no right going out to play, right? So if you're having trouble kind of organizing your days and you might have a lot more client work than I do, or something like that, that would be like the first thing I would do for inventory, as well as any admin tasks that you're doing that are easily doable by somebody else, that either somebody's better at it or can do it and you don't have to do it, that it's not revenue generating and you don't maybe enjoy it, or even if you do enjoy it, that you don't need to be doing it. So that's kind of my tips about getting stuff done and organizing. I hope that was helpful. Let me know. Yeah. It's really hard. Yeah, that was a really good question, Sarah. Thanks for asking that. Okay. Let's see. Oh, okay, Nicole. You know what's really fun about this Sjogren's syndrome that I have? You have dry mouth, which is, and then leading to the dry throat, and mine has gone to my vocal cords, so that's why my vocal cords are all messed up. But you also have really bad dry eyes, so I have trouble seeing too, and then it's gone down, and it's gone to my kidney and my liver, so it's perfect. So I'm just laughing as I'm like trying to read this. I'm like, I can't see. It's really not a big deal. It's just annoying. Yeah, this is a good question, Nicole. So it all depends on what your term section and your termination and your term section says in your contract. So if you know that this is like a consistent thing for your clients, maybe it's something that you say to them like, hey, from now on, or like, you know, that when they sign up, they do this, you put something in the term and termination section that says something like, if the client chooses to add something on, then, you know, the contract term will continue until canceled, or, you know, or something like that. Otherwise, yes, you do need to get them to sign a new contract every time. Yeah, if you don't have the term and termination section right, that would be an issue. So that's what I would look at, Nicole. Carla said that she doesn't have an LLC, but she has a DBA. I'm always confused by this because you can't have a DBA unless you have a business, but I'm assuming that you live in a state where you don't have to register as a sole proprietor and that's what you are. So that would be my concern. I can't tell you whether or not, you know, you might, whether this might fall under trademark infringement, because sometimes like words being the same matters, sometimes it doesn't. It depends what industry they're in, if they have trademark themselves, like there's just so many things. Also, somebody's domain name doesn't matter. Like someone can have the same domain name as you. That doesn't really matter. Yeah, and I'm not sure if they had a trademark on their website. So there's a little bit of digging that you have to do here as to like, do they have a trademark on this name? Is it just their business name? What's their business registered as? But I would also get your business actually registered as an LLC, and then maybe you look into trademark. You could speak to a trademark attorney about whether or not that person's been using it longer than you. That's something you could do a little digging and do some research on. And maybe they'll come back. I don't know if you've done a trademark search, but this is also the benefit, everybody, to registering your name. To actually registering your business in your state is like, you know, whether anybody else in your state is using this name. But then when it comes to more like trademark stuff, we have to look at, are people using it anywhere else in the country, right? So yeah. All right. Okay, Raj. Raj, I need you for my Sjogren's syndrome. So Raj, if you are a physician who's providing coaching, then and you want to be seen as a coach because you can then, you know, work with people everywhere and virtually and all of that kind of stuff, you can only do what a coach can do. Your scope isn't expanded because you're a physician, because you don't want to be accused of like the unauthorized practice of medicine in the states where you're not licensed. But you can still coach on mindset and Ayurvedic medicine, right? Like you can still do that. You just have to act like a coach. So you can't give them advice. You can't prescribe. You can't try to tell them, you know, an exact protocol to follow or something like this, but you can educate, you can guide, you can do all those things. It's just about being careful. I think you might have mentioned that you joined the bundle recently. So if so, make sure you watch the scope of practice trainings. But that's going to be most helpful for you. Yeah. Okay, I wanted to answer this because I saw this one come in. Lindsay asked, is it legal to work only with women? You know, it's interesting. It's it could be considered discrimination. I think that's what I have to tell you because every state has different laws. And I would just bring you back to like the original principle that I teach you all the time, which is like people can sue you for anything. And I think there are wackadoodles out there who will be like, I don't like that you say women only. I remember where I grew up outside Philly, there was like a, I mean, it wasn't really like a nightclub. It was more like where people would go, like adults would go like dancing at night. It was like a bar with dancing. And on Tuesdays, they always had ladies' night. And I remember this guy sued them because he said that he didn't think it was fair that ladies got in free. And the court actually ended up finding that it was discriminatory. Now that's a little different because when you have a restaurant, if something is seen as a restaurant or a hotel, it brings on different discrimination things, but I don't know. It's just, it's tricky. That's what I would say. I think my tip would be to not be, 'cause you asked if I have any guidance, like my tip would be to not be so explicit, like women only, or something like that. Do you remember that, Shani? It was in Cherry Hill. So yeah, I wouldn't be super explicit. Obviously, you can seek advice. Me too, by the way. You could seek advice from your own attorney about whether like in your state that this is an issue. But the problem is with an online business, if you're working with people from elsewhere, then you could be violating some discrimination law in that state. And I don't know, it just like really depends on what you all do. 'Cause if you do something in healthcare, maybe that's seen as being discriminatory. Like I used to have I had no rule about not working with men personally, but we used to have much more like marketing messaging copy about like women not having access to certain legal things or being intimidated. And you know, I was kind of fine with it, but then I just revisited it. It was like, I don't know why I have that because I'm not opposed to guys buying my stuff. And so I removed it because it was more just like a unintentional thing that I had thought about. So yeah, it is a tricky one that I don't have like a super clear answer for you because I think it really depends on lots of different states' laws. Oh, Shani, that's funny. You're from that area. I grew up in Haddonfield, in case you know it. And my dad lived in Cherry Hill. Yeah. Okay. Okay, Natalie asked about Kajabi. So at the time I moved from Teachable to Kajabi just because Teachable was limiting me in terms of the way the course was presented and how we had to like go through their payment system in order to get people to buy it, and I didn't want to do that. I think that Teachable has developed since I left it, so I'm like nothing against. I'm not like anti-Teachable. And Kajabi's fine. I mean, my big beef with Kajabi is that it's so expensive. I think it's so limiting. Like they call everything a product. So every time we add like a legal template or we sell like a different product, they consider it a product. And then you get a very tight limit on how many products you can sell for the tier that you're at. And like I pay an insane amount of money and I'm so limited in the number of products. Like that just seems stupid. I don't like that. I really hate about Kajabi the checkout process because you can't have like multiple payment options. So you would have to have separate checkout pages for all the different payment options, and that's not happening for me. So I use Samcart. So if you've ever come to my events before, you know I always say that the way that I do this is not the most cost efficient or anything like that. It's like, you know, you get to a certain place in business where you're just like, I want to use the best products, and I know it costs us more money, and it's okay, but it's not what I would have done years ago. So I'm pretty honest about that. In terms of Thinkific, I've only used it as a user, like on the customer end, and it's fine. I mean, I really take it seriously, like what the like what the product looks like on your end. And so I want it to be really easy to use. Like that was what was number one to me. And I thought that Kajabi was the best for that. You guys can all tell me, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought Kajabi was like the cleanest, easiest to use. They have an app, you like the logins easy. I just thought it was easy. I thought it looked better than Teachable at the time, but I'm not sure what it looks like now. And I think it looks better than Thinkific, but that's kind of like, I would really focus on the, for anybody who's picking a tool for anything, I would really focus on just getting started with something and then you can always switch later. Yeah. I would look for a lawyer who specifically does book stuff. I had a lawyer, my agent, my book agent got me a lawyer in New York City who only reviews book publishing contracts. And so I don't know if you're working with anyone, but you can ask them that. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, I think Google's going to be your friend here to like look for somebody who works in an attorney who does book contracts, publishing contracts, something like that. Yeah, because it's a lot. My contract was serious. There was a lot happening. Yeah, I typically go by the like, yes, unless they tell you otherwise. I only ever had one person who was like, no, you can't use our logo. I thought that was really weird. And I don't know who wouldn't want you to, but yeah, that's my take. So the beneficial ownership registration is this new requirement that we all have to essentially register with the federal government, like who owns our business. And that information is supposed to only stay with the government, and it's only supposed to be able to be available to them and available to other people if they there's some legal issue, like a formal request of some sort. There's some litigation pending about it, but the rule generally has been that you're still required to do it. I actually have a free BOI guide and we have that linked in the bundle. So and a training, and I did a walkthrough of how to fill out your BOI. It's free, it takes 5 minutes, and it's really easy. So I would get it done. Yeah, super easy, right? Good question, Sarah. I think that it's, well, first of all, it's not mutually exclusive. Like I'm somebody who has a higher ticket option, but then offers a payment plan, which almost acts like a subscription because then I get consistent recurring revenue, like a very, very high amount of recurring revenue every month, which is a great like foundational, like I know how much is going to come in. If we didn't sell anything else, like this is how much is coming in. So it's kind of like a best of both worlds, in my opinion. In general, though, like, there's always the thought that if you sell something cheaper, like it's easier in some way, but it's very hard because of volume. So if you're doing a membership and it's $49 a month or $99 a month, think about how many people you have to sell that to. So do you have the volume in your business? Do you have enough people on your email list, on Instagram? Do you have a YouTube following? Like, do you have enough people to sell to? Is it in demand enough? And it's my understanding with memberships that it seems like it's kind of hard to keep up. Like it's you're doing a lot of work. Like you're adding a lot, or then people will often tap other people to add. I know people do it very successfully, but it just never seemed to make sense to me to build the business on like, oh, I have to go out and find a ton of people in order for this thing to be successful. 'Cause like I don't need that many people to buy the bundle in order for us to do well. So it's a little bit more manageable. So that's just my take on it. And then, like I said, you can try the payment plan so that you have a little bit of both worlds. That's the way I would think about it. Okay. Oh, right. Let's see here. I don't know of any low budget HIPAA compliant forms that I am not familiar with. And then also, I would always encourage all of you to be like, are you even subject to HIPAA? Because are you a provider through it? That's something that's important to know. And then also, like, are you collecting personal health information and you're not a doctor or some other qualified professional? And so then why are we collecting personal health information? So that's what I always think of when this question comes up. It's just like, why are we creating it? Or why are we collecting it? Are we allowed to be collecting it? And then are you even subject to HIPAA in the first place? But I'm not familiar with any creation tools, but that's something you could probably Google, or you can look in like a resource group that you're in, maybe, or something like that. Feel free to post it in the Facebook community. Like maybe somebody there has done something, or they've used it before. All right. Oh, there are a lot of legal considerations you should be aware of before recording your clients and showing it to other people. You would absolutely need their consent, and permission, and you would want that in writing, not verbally. But you would want to build that into your contract. But that's one of those things where, like, even if you built it into your contract, I would have conversations about it with people, like point it out on your contract, make sure they understand, because I think people could be very upset if they didn't know that ahead of time. But that's something you'd absolutely be legally required to have their permission. Before recording their session, and absolutely before sharing it with anyone else. And we do have that info in the contract templates. Okay. I think that's all the questions I see here. Let me see if there's anything else. Yeah, thank you guys so much for being here. If nobody has any other questions, this was You guys always have the best questions. I really, really appreciate it. I'm happy to hang out for a sec, but otherwise, I hope you have a great rest of your day. If you haven't already, just let me know in the chat if you would be interested in that AI training, if I created it for you all. And then what was the other thing I wanted to know? Oh, well, that we also posted the Substack link at the beginning. So if you all are on Substack, come over and say hi. Yeah, I really want to do this training. I think it could be helpful. Thanks. All right. Thanks everybody for hanging out. Oh yeah, go ahead, Sarah. It's fine. If a celebrity shows your product, then what? Maybe you accidentally hit enter. Yeah, you're so welcome. Yep, we'll send out the replay when it's available. Thank you. Sarah asked a really good question. If a celebrity showed your product on Instagram, could you use that on her website? Yeah, the reason you can do that is because whatever people post to Instagram is not like you would just like reshare. Like you can't like download it and upload it or whatever, but you would like embed it with a link. That's totally fine because what people post on Instagram, they don't own anymore. You give that up to Instagram. And as of yesterday, that was the deadline for Meta to be able to scrape anything you've ever posted on Facebook, Instagram or Threads to build their AI machine. So anything, any photo, video, copy, anything you put there can be used by them for their own purposes. Yeah. Elena said, a legal question. You have to follow their terms, Elena. Whatever the like Unsplash says in their terms, or it, for that specific picture is like what's allowed. You have to follow that. Yeah. Susan's asking if it's too late to take the permission away. The reason I didn't really share about it is because in the U.S. it was kind of useless. Like, there Meta's not required to honor your removal request, and so I submitted one for us to see how it went, and I submitted a formal request to Meta to say that they're not able to use our AI, sorry, our content for building out their AI machine. I did it through their official form that they had buried very deeply onto their website, and they rejected our request because they don't have to honor it if you live in the US. If you live in the EU, they had to honor it. So it's really had me in a very bad mood this week. I'm very annoyed about it. Yeah. Elena, I can't tell you if there's nothing beyond that. Like there might be something beyond that, but in general, like I don't know how you're using it and where, and like there's a lot to a lot of these kinds of things. But in terms of like that website, you always want to follow the terms of what the license is that you're allowed to use the photo for. Yeah. Yeah, Raj, that's why I didn't tell everybody because it was really quite useless and it was difficult and like I had to have Lindsay do it for me. It was difficult and time consuming and it just wasn't worth it for everybody to do it, only for them to say no. I don't know. So I'll keep everybody in the loop as to like what happens. The form is like really, really dug deep. I'm hoping also there's going to be some legislation that comes out of this. Like one of my favorite food bloggers actually yesterday testified before Congress about how AI is impacting small businesses and creators. So I'm hoping this is like relatively on their radar. I'm actually thinking of getting in touch with my local congressman and telling him our story of like what's happening with my own business and what I see happening with all of your businesses and with social media, and that I'm a lawyer and I'm trying to help in that way. But I think they don't even understand what's happening, and I think it's all happening really fast. Yeah, it's a little scary. Yeah. Oh, thanks, Sarah. I would love that. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I appreciate everybody being there. And yeah, I am with you, Shani. I'm big SEO gal myself. So I really appreciate everybody being here. We'll get the replay to you as soon as we can and the list of questions. And if you forgot anything and think of it later, just let me know. Also, the Ultimate Bundle's on sale until tomorrow. So if you have any other friends or family or colleagues, or there's any Facebook groups you're in or whatever, and you want to let people know about the sale, I would really, really appreciate it. Hopefully you've already signed up for our affiliate program. That's inside the bundle. You can do that. So you can make a little kickback for referring people. But yeah, it's on sale until tomorrow. Even if you just have time to give us a shout out on social media and tag us or leave a really nice comment on a recent reel, that's really, really helpful to us. But if the bundle or I or anything in it or Leanne or anybody's been helpful to you, I would just really, really appreciate anything you can do for that. So with that, I hope you all have a great day. Thank you so much. See you. Yeah, thank you.